This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the U.S. Republican presidential hopefuls take part in a third debate. Internet freedom on the decline.
For the fifth consecutive years, they're charting a drop in global internet freedoms. They surveyed the large majority of countries that have sort of, you know, extensive internet access, that kind of thing.
Exercise pills could replace working out. And British pop star Adele makes music again. These and other stories just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. The race for the White House in 2016 continued Wednesday with a debate of the top 10 Republican presidential contenders. Billionaire businessman Donald Trump came into their third debate of the campaign season, suddenly trailing retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson in a series of polls. The debate was held at the University of Colorado in the western city of Boulder, Colorado. Senior national correspondent Jim Malone is here to talk about how it went. Jim, any big news out of the debate?
Well, Ray, I guess I would have to look at the performance of someone like Senator Marco Rubio, who was pretty smooth. He had a combination of effective attacks in the debate and some effective defense when he was challenged by none other than his political mentor, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, about the fact that Rubio has missed a lot of votes in the Senate while running for president. Rubio came back at Bush by saying, "You didn't accuse John McCain of the same thing. You're doing it now against me because you're running against me." And so that got a fairly good reaction in the crowd. Overall, though, I have to say that not a lot stood out in this third debate. Donald Trump was not as dominant as he has been in previous debates. Ben Carson, who came into the debate with all that momentum, was Ben Carson, which means he was relatively quiet, sticking to his talking points and pointedly refusing to get into the attack mode, even when invited by some of the moderators on the debate.
There seemed to be less time attacking each other and more criticism of the opposition Democrats and Hillary Clinton specifically this time.
Yeah, there were several times. Chris Christie was very strong about that. Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky. A number of them took turns going after Hillary Clinton, including Carly Fiorina, who said Clinton and the Democrats have not done that much for women, and that she was trying to assert her leadership should she win the presidency. There were some back and forths, though, between the contenders. Early on in the debate, Ohio Governor John Kasich kind of went after the outsiders in the race, Trump and Carson, by saying that some of their proposals were from fantasy land. Their economic proposals didn't add up, especially Carson on wanting to cut everyone's taxes and have everyone pay the same rate of 10%. Carson in the debate, by the way, said it would be 15%. But in any event, that prompted a strong response from Trump, who said to Kasich, "Well, that's why you're on the end of the row here," meaning you're low in the polls, and of course Trump is not. But that was one sort of mini-clash, and then of course there was Bush and Rubio.
The candidates also went after the questions and the questioners.
Yeah, they did. They were really pushing back several times. Ted Cruz, the senator from Texas, described it as though the moderators were looking to foment some sort of a cage match between them. And he even recited some of the questions that went to some of his rivals. And he got a huge response from the crowd when he said, "Why don't you ask us about these substantive issues that matter to voters?" And that sort of brought the house down. So I think, yes, in the aftermath of the debate, a lot of the discussion will be, especially from the conservative side, the moderators seemed too intent on trying to foment, inner party rivalries and get the candidates to go after one another.
And Jim, where do the Republican presidential hopefuls go from here?
Well, they don't have a lot of time to rest up in terms of debate prep, if that's what they're concerned about, because in 2 weeks' time, they'll be back at it with yet another Republican debate, we're in a cycle now. We have a Republican debate each month and a Democratic debate now coming up also in mid-November. That'll be their second. So I'm not sure this debate moved the needle much in terms of shifting poll numbers. We'll have to wait for that. But certainly, I think Marco Rubio may be feeling good about it. Some of the other candidates who had less time, who didn't talk as much during the debate, people like Mike Huckabee, Rand Paul, and a few others, they might be hurting, because if you don't get that opportunity to speak and break through, your poll numbers are either going to sit where they are or decline.
Jim, thanks. Jim Malone, VOA senior national correspondent. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says talks in Vienna on Syria's future are the most promising opportunity in years for reaching a political solution in a war-torn country that has suffered 4.5 years of what he called nonstop horror. Secretary Kerry spoke Wednesday at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace here in Washington.
Military operations are but one of the many components of what the coalition is doing. We're working hard to counter Daesh's propaganda and to deter potential foreign fighters from joining it. In partnership with the UAE, we have established a center in Abu Dhabi that is offering positive messages across the region on the internet and all through social media, talking about politics, religion, and the responsibilities of faith. And we're striving to cut off Daesh's funding so that it becomes bankrupt politically just as it is morally. But ultimately, to defeat Daesh, we have to end the war in Syria. And that is America's goal.
Secretary Kerry says the U.S. is taking a two-pronged approach to Syria. One is diplomatic. The other is intensifying the counter-Islamic State campaign conducted by a U.S.-led coalition. I spoke with VOA editor Molly McKitterick about what might be giving Secretary Kerry such cause for optimism.
I think he's very excited about the talks that are coming up. They're preliminary talks Thursday, and then the talks themselves get started on Friday, which are aimed at finding a political solution in Syria. And he's very optimistic about them. He called them the most promising opportunity in years.
How have the circumstances changed now at this time as opposed to previous efforts?
That's a good question. I think the fact that he's got Russia, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, the U.S. and Iran are coming to the table. I think maybe the fact that these people are coming to the table and that they're ready to talk. He wasn't specific about why he thought this was a great opportunity. He did say, though, that he thought these had a lot of potential, these talks.
Russia's coming to the table, and yet they're dropping bombs from the air.
Well, that's what lawmakers asked today on Capitol Hill. They said, you know, you've got the facts on the ground over here with Russia, and then you've got these talks. Where's the optimism? Kerry said that in addition to the talks, though, that one of the things that the U.S. and the U.S. coalition is doing is stepping up its offensive in Syria, or against the Islamic State in Syria. So he's saying it's a two-pronged approach. And maybe somewhere in the balance there, he sees something that's giving him cause for hope.
On Capitol Hill, what are the lawmakers feeling about this?
That we have this sort of dire situation with Russians backing Assad and then the U.S. not backing Assad. And how is there any way that a political solution can come out of that? And that's what we're going to see in the next couple of weeks, I guess.
VOA editor Molly McKitterick. U.S. diplomats do not expect a definitive conclusion to the talks this week. Instead, they believe there will be further rounds of talks about Syria's political future. Just 2 days after a major earthquake struck northern Afghanistan, Taliban insurgents overran the district capital of Dharkand in Takhar province on the border with Tajikistan, a month after briefly capturing the provincial capital of Kunduz. This latest setback for Kabul comes as both the Afghan and Pakistani governments grapple with the aftermath of the 7.5 magnitude quake that killed or injured thousands. Dr. Arif Noor, country director of Mercy Corps in Islamabad, is a veteran of the 2005 quake that crippled the same region and killed at least 75,000 people. He told International Edition's Victor Beatty the most immediate threat to victims this time is not the Taliban, but their remoteness, making relief and resupply a logistical challenge, as well as the oncoming winter weather.
Luckily, the loss to life has not been as severe as was initially feared. But since the earthquake has hit primarily the areas which are very remote and very difficult to access even under normal circumstances. After the earthquake, several roads have been destroyed because of landslides and rock falls up in the mountain. And there are still very small villages which are located up in the mountains or deep in the valleys. We don't really know what's happening over there. From our experience, and we have been working in some of these districts for the past so many years, we know that initially, apart from medical help that these people need, food and water, a most important need going forward will be shelter. It's very difficult to immediately rebuild their places or build permanent shelters, sort of semi-permanent shelters. That's going to be a huge need for those areas because these are mostly up in the mountains or deep in the valleys. And the winter has already set in. And many of the areas which have been currently hit by the current earthquake were also hit by the 2005 earthquake.
What can international charity groups do, and are they beginning to respond?
Some of us, we are in the process of doing initial assessments. The government so far has, and that's a standard procedure. If a calamity is really big, then the government makes a formal appeal to the international community. So far, the government has indicated that they will be able to handle the situation themselves.
Despite the fact that some of the areas affected have been controlled by the Taliban, apparently the Taliban is encouraging everyone of goodwill to send in relief and implying that they won't hamper the relief efforts.
This is their usual tactic. They try to gain the sympathies of the local population. I'm sure you would recall the horrible incident in Peshawar when more than 100 school children were massacred by the Taliban. So after that, the army has really gone after the terrorists in a very strong and determined way. So even if they do try to hamper the relief efforts, our sense is that apart from maybe very, very small, very, very remote areas, they won't be able to do much.
Dr. Arif Noor, country director of Mercy Corps in Islamabad, says he expects the relief efforts to continue until March when the weather will finally improve. He spoke with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Still to come, how to exercise without exercising. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? It's called Robohan, a smartphone that's also your personal assistant. The big deal about Robohan is it has voice and face recognition. At a technology show just outside Tokyo, future customers got a chance to preview the phone made by Sharp.
It's capable of various things. There are many kinds of ways to use it.
Robohan was made to talk to you, to announce new emails, scheduled appointments, birthdays, etc., etc. Robohan is also, of course, a camera, and with its head-mounted projector, it can display media on almost any flat surface.
Okay.
Is this device practicable? Well, walking down the street with its head in your ear while you're talking to its feet may not be the look you're going for, but Sharp says the robot phone is mostly just for fun. A good backup or secondary phone. It's expected to be available in Japan sometime next year. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossons.
This is VOA's International Edition. Internet freedom around the world declined for the fifth consecutive year in 2015 as more governments censored information of public interest while also expanding surveillance and cracking down on privacy tools. A new Freedom House report provides details, which VOA's Doug Bernard shared with International Edition's Susan Yockey.
Well, this is an annual report that Freedom House puts out. This is the sixth year they've put it out. And as they say, for the fifth consecutive years, they're charting a drop in global internet freedoms. They surveyed the large majority of countries that have sort of, you know, extensive internet access, that kind of thing. Now, across the board, it's one thing to say freedoms are dropping. They cite specific examples of countries that weren't surprising, China, Russia, Iran cracking down online, as well as Thailand. These aren't really surprising, just given their past history. But some nations they point out, for example, France, Australia, these are nations that have a history of a very free internet, and yet in response to either terrorist activities or other things, in France, for example, the Charlie Hebdo shootings, there have been restrictions of what people can say and how they can say it online. So essentially the report is chronicling, you know, yet again, bad news. We're getting a little less free on the web.
Well, this is a difficult thing to talk about because there's, you can see both sides of the coin. They've got to be very careful with terrorism this day.
Well, of course, and I think, you know, reasonable people expect that. One of the areas that they cite is encryption. Encryption, these are tools that we use to kind of hide ourselves, hide our traffic, so governments can't come in and censor us or monitor us or spy on us. But, of course, encryption has a dark side, too. It can be used by criminals. It can be used by terrorists to hide their footprints, their digital footprints, as it were. So, like a lot of things on the web, these things cut both ways. But in the end, I think overall, the sense of evaporating or constricting freedom online is not a good trend.
Do these people, do they recommend anything?
There's no set of recommendations, but there is one area that they highlight. I think it's very interesting. Basically, they're charting how in the past it was more likely that a government would come in and block a website or ban a website, that sort of thing, sort of a very heavy-handed action. Well, as people have grown sophisticated, we've talked about these various techniques, you know, those blocks and bans don't work so well anymore. So what Freedom House is charting is how governments are getting very clever about pressuring the internet service providers or the internet companies like Facebook, Google, those kinds, into removing material themselves, maybe even self-censoring. So the Freedom House researchers say this is an area of great concern and one where industry needs to push back strongly against government pressure.
VOA social media correspondent Doug Bernard speaking with International Edition's Susan Yockey. Turning now to what's buzzing online, and here's International Edition's G. Abby Lee. Hello, G. What's new?
Hi, Ray. One of the top 10 shared stories on Facebook here in America has to do with a little girl fighting a rare and incurable disease. CNN did a story on Juliana, who has Charcot-Marie tooth disease, also known as CMT. It's a hereditary neuropathy, which means your nerves are abnormal and you get the condition from your older family members.
How did the press find out about this family?
Well, from Juliana's mother, who has a blog. So Michelle is a neurologist and writes about the family's struggles with CMT. One of the entries is included in the CNN article, and it's about a conversation she had with Juliana about a year ago. It goes like this. She asked, "Juliana, if you get sick again, do you want to go to the hospital or stay home?" Juliana replied, "Not the hospital." Michelle asked, "Even if that means that you will go to heaven if you stay home?" And Juliana answered, "Yes." When Michelle elaborated, "Mommy and Daddy won't be able to come with you right away." Juliana said, "Don't worry. God will take care of me."
Gee, that's a very heartbreaking dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Did the family honor her decision?
They sure did. And that's why it's making headlines. If Juliana were an adult, then of course most people would expect the parents to respect her decision. But she was only 4 years old then, so some people feel that maybe the parents should make decisions for her until she's grown. But Juliana's doctor apparently told Michelle and her husband Steve that there was no right or wrong answer when it comes to that question.
Obviously, it's not an easy decision at all for any parents to
make
or should ever have to make.
Mm-hmm.
So how is Juliana doing now?
Well, she actually celebrated an anniversary last Saturday. October 24th marked a full year of Juliana not going to the hospital.
And could you tell us how we can keep posted about this brave little girl and her family?
Sure. You can follow their journey on Michelle's blog at julianayuri.com. That's JulianaYuri. Ray?
Thanks, G. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee, and that's spelled JeeAbbeyLee. And also by following our program account at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition, coming to you from Washington. Wouldn't it be great to take an exercise pill and get all of the benefits of a workout without the work and sweat? Such drugs are now being developed, but one expert is cautioning not to expect too much from a pill that simulates exercise. Here's Jessica Berman.
There are approximately 8 compounds now in the works that would give users the benefits of a workout for as long as people take the pill. Ishmael Lahar is a pharmacologist at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. Lahar and colleagues did a systematic review published in the journal Trends in Pharmacological Sciences, looking at the physical benefits of a number of experimental drugs that would help build muscles without moving a muscle. Lahar says there are at least 1,000 different positive impacts that exercise has on muscles, but the exercise compounds mimic the physiological benefits of only one muscle function, the building of skeletal muscles, without the danger and side effects of steroids.
My sense is that, you know, this is not a magic pill for exercise. What these pills will do is take the magic out of exercise.
Lahar stresses that physical exercise has a number of health benefits, including improved cardiovascular health and helping diabetics manage their disease, which exercise pills cannot match. But Lahar says they would be useful in helping people with spinal cord injuries who are unable to move to get some of the benefits of a workout.
Let's focus on where we can make a positive impact on this, and then go from there and target those populations, but not target the able-bodied person who can exercise.
Lahar says clinical trials in humans still need to be done to find out whether exercise pills are a wonder drug. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
My sense is that, you know, this is not a magic pill for exercise. What these pills will do is take the magic.
Fans of Adele are no doubt happy to see the British pop singer back in the spotlight with a new album out. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald chatted with International Edition's Jim Stevenson all about it.
Hello, it's me. I was wondering if after all these years you'd like to meet, to go over everything.
Ray, you know, I haven't heard much of Adele lately, but she's back.
Yeah, and just for those whose memories may need refreshing, back in 2011, Adele, the British pop singer, released her second album, 21, and it absolutely blew up internationally. Mm. It ended up selling 30 million copies worldwide. In 2012, Time magazine named Adele one of the most influential people in the world. And in 2013, her James Bond theme, Skyfall, earned Adele an Academy Award, a Grammy, and a Golden Globe. Mm. Now, as far as the low profile goes, in 2012, Adele and her partner, Simon Konecki, had a baby boy, Angelo. And Adele is a private person to begin with. And when Angelo was born, she really just maintained radio silence and became a mom for a couple of years. She wanted to raise her little boy. Well, now she has emerged again. This week, Adele went on Twitter to tell all her fans that her next album will be titled 25.
Sticking with the number theme.
Sticking with the age theme, exactly. Mm-hmm. It will hit the market on November 20th. And this has some significance because before this, everybody was keeping their eye on the November 13th release dates of Justin Bieber's next album and One Direction's next album. And this was supposed to be the commercial clash of the titans. Well, now Adele is the new player in the November sweepstakes. So it's really interesting now.
Hello. How are you? It's so typical of me to talk about myself. I'm sorry.
The lead single is called Hello. So that's going to be the big lead-in song. It will also feature a music video shot near Montreal, Canada. Adele posted the track listing for 25. It features 11 songs. Now, she didn't go into detail about the song credits, but those rumored to have worked with Adele on the new album include Phil Collins, Danger Mouse, Max Martin, one of the most popular and prolific songwriters in pop music, Sia, and Ryan Tedder of OneRepublic, who also worked with Adele on 21. She's calling the new album a makeup record, as opposed to 21, which was a breakup record because some guy broke her heart, and that was the inspiration for that album.
Can we expect a tour?
That's a good question. Adele is a famously private artist, and she's one of the very few artists who doesn't need to make her living from touring.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good question. I would expect that Adele will do a few dates.
We look forward to it, as we always look forward to Ray joining us each and every week. Follow him in his Top 20 Countdown and on Twitter.
At Ray on the hits.
Yes.
Thank you,
Ray.
And that'll do it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a raid on an ISIL prison near the town of Hawija, Iraq, Peshmerga fighters, aided by U.S. special forces at the request of the Kurdistan Regional Government, rescued approximately 70 hostages. More than 20 of the captives were reportedly Iraqi security force members. The operation was planned after receiving information that the hostages faced imminent mass execution. Four Peshmerga fighters were wounded in the rescue mission. A U.S. service member acting in support of Peshmerga fighters who came under heavy fire by ISIL was wounded and later died. He is the first U.S. soldier to be killed in Iraq since 2011. At a press briefing, Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter spoke of U.S. serviceman Master Sergeant Joshua Wheeler.
The sacrifice and decisive action of this courageous American in support of his comrades reminds us of the dangers that the coalition forces confront in Iraq, but also of the important assistance they provide local forces as they lead the fight against a barbaric enemy.
Dozens of ISIL fighters were killed in the raid on the prison camp near Hawija, and five ISIL terrorists were detained by Peshmerga forces. In addition, important intelligence about ISIL was recovered. Secretary of Defense Carter authorized the rescue mission as part of Operation Inherent Resolve, the campaign to defeat ISIL through support to Iraq security forces, including the Kurdish Peshmerga.
Obviously, saving the lives that were about to be brutally sacrificed is the main thing, and supporting our Peshmerga partners who have been wonderful fighters. But then it turns out we'll get good information as well.
Defense Secretary Carter said the U.S. Defense Department remains laser-focused on the execution of our counter-ISIL strategy. In the case of the Hawija prison raid, he said the support of U.S. forces helped our partners prevent a mass killing and enabled them to deliver to ISIL a clear defeat.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.